You're the president of the United States fighting aliens in a simulation, but you're going to commit some insurance fraud right now. This is Up, Up, Down, Down, the world's first podcast about video games. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, a 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment, later Activision. Who's now the co-founder of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
Also joining us is Parveen Kaler, also a recovering video game developer. Parveen was previously at Relic and Slant 6 Games, but has since made a name for himself in the iOS development scene.
Hi, everybody.
So our topic for today, for what it's worth, is sequelitis, the current state of AAA game publishing and indie game publishing, and how sequels are ruining it for everybody. So I imagine Nigel, having spent the longest in the games industry, has the strongest opinions about this. but this isn't often a topic when we're having lunch or what have you, that I have a tendency to rail against this. And I think there's no better place to start than Guitar Hero. Would you guys agree with that?
I would actually disagree with that, but I'll let you make your case for Guitar Hero being a good archetype for this before I demolish it.
Okay, excellent. So Guitar Hero is kind of personal to me because I loved Guitar Hero. I guess I still do love it. It's just I'm not actively playing it because Activision killed it. They released 11 Guitar Hero titles in 5 years, which if you do the math is too many. And you know, they went from making ridiculous amounts of money to making no money because they brutally murdered not only the Guitar Hero franchise specifically, but the entire genre of having fun in your living room, drinking and singing poorly. And you know, that the whole world is just a little bit worse off.
You want to go at that, Nigel, first?
Sure. So I don't think Guitar Hero is a great example of the problems with sequelitis. Like, certainly a big part of why Guitar Hero died was because they overmilked it. But I think Guitar Hero is a real edge case in that respect, in a lot of ways, that no franchise other than Guitar Hero has basically ever had that many releases that close together. And Guitar Hero is a really unusual games in a lot of ways that makes it way easier to burn out on than most games. Like, you've got this hardware that you've got to purchase and manage and deal with. You've got the real, like, casual gaming factor that was a game that appealed to a lot of people that other games didn't appeal to, which obviously helps somewhat with, you know, making money off a game, but it also means that, you know, that people aren't really going to be interested necessarily in trying a lot of different things or trying a lot of unusual things. And people are just going to kind of, you know, get one or two of the games and get their guitars and just keep playing the same songs that they like. So I think Guitar Hero, like, it's a real outlier. If you compare other big franchises and what's happened with them to what's happened with Guitar Hero is really the only one that flamed out to that degree. You know, something like Call of Duty, like the latest Call of Duty Ghosts, I think is like the 10th Call of Duty game. And basically everyone, you know, exceeds the previous one in terms of sales and, I don't know, maybe not in terms of critical acclaim, but
definitely not in terms of critical
acclaim. Certainly the critical acclaim of the series hasn't cratered, right? Like, no one's going around saying, like, oh, you know, Modern Warfare was just totally awesome and all the later games are total crap. You know, it's more along the lines of, like, oh, okay, well, you know, there was a bit of a high point to the series and maybe it's declined a little bit now, but it hasn't cratered in the same way that something like Guitar Hero did. So I think Guitar Hero is a bad example just because it's such an outlier.
Yeah, I think Guitar Hero is a little bit of a bad example. For example, Call of Duty, to me, Call of Duty is just like another Castle Wolfenstein or Doom. It's like, dude, I already played a first-person shooter in like 1994 or 1995 or whatever. Like, I can't really be bothered to play first-person shooters anymore. Like I can't care enough to like spend the $60, sit on my couch with a crappy gamepad playing same game that I've been playing for 20 years. That's what it feels like to me when I'm playing this first person shooter. Whereas Guitar Hero is a little bit different. So I was the nerd that I was at Relic Entertainment, I think, actually, when Guitar Hero came out. And I was the nerd that walked to Future Shop at lunchtime, day of first release, and bought a Guitar Hero on the first day. And I brought it back to the office, and then everyone kind of like pointed at me and laughed for being the nerd carrying around a fake plastic guitar.
Little did they know.
Little did they
know. Yeah, I bet you they weren't laughing for very long.
A week later, everyone was into it. So a week later, Guitar Hero really was a phenomenon. And I wouldn't put them under the sequelitis umbrella because you don't have to kind of buy every single version. Like, for example, the way that music licensing works, I guess they had to make sequels, I have no idea why they made so many sequels. But like, you know, the Guitar Hero 80s hairband version, yeah, I'm not probably not going to play that one. And it doesn't really matter if you don't play those ones. Whereas in other games, if there is a storyline component, I guess you kind of have to go through every single sequel to be in on it.
I want to get back to that thing about having to follow every game. But I think the interesting thing about Guitar Hero is that they had something that was fun, that people agree was fun, and that if they had just kept it in their pants and had a new one every like 2 or 3 years, then we would still have an enjoyable game every once in a while. But as it is, it's gone. And I mean, maybe not forever. Maybe in a few console generations, they'll come back and be like, oh, this great new idea. We can play with plastic instruments. But they couldn't pace themselves. And so it actually died entirely. Was unnecessary.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, there's no way to go back and run that experiment. Like, you know, probably Guitar Hero would have done better if they'd spaced out a little more. And I think that's, you know, it's not that Guitar Hero is not a point against that kind of sequelitis and milking franchises at all. It's just such an over-the-top case. Like, the sheer volume of releases, and it was a volume of releases in a genre that had some of those factors that made it a bit of a fad and made it burn out a little bit. Anyways, like the combination of all those factors was enough to put it under. More the point I'm making is that there's plenty of other things that have been milked pretty badly that just haven't failed the same way that Guitar Hero did.
Yeah, there's also the issue of the pylon by Rock Band. So now you're getting 2x the number of sequels in that same genre. So I can understand why some people would get tired of that.
And I mean, for me, fundamentally, like the reason I kind of stopped playing Guitar Hero really was just kind of like a physical logistics factor, right? Like there's other games that for me are in that sort of casual, like, hey, here's something that I can just play if I have some time to kill. And I don't so much play those on consoles anymore because now like iOS devices usually fill that niche for me. But I've got like a couple of fighting games over the years and like racing games, and I'm not really a fighting game guy or a racing game guy, but I'll like have them around as like fun party games or something to just play a little bit occasionally. And it's easy to do that with those games because it's just a disc. But Guitar Hero, if I decide I want to play Guitar Hero, I got to like, okay, I got to figure out where the instruments are and like figure out, you know, have I lost the pedal for the drums, and I got to haul them all upstairs and I got to bolt them back together. And I got to go and track down like 10 different like charged AA batteries in order to make everything work. And like,
God help you it's the Wii version. And then you have like the Wiimotes have been disassembled into various pieces and spread across the house.
I probably would still be playing Guitar Hero if like I could just materialize the instruments through sheer force of will when I wanted to play, rather than having to like go and find them and bring them into the living room and play with them. Cause
that would make a good sequel.
Yeah. That would be, if they could get that down, that would be pretty awesome. But yeah, all of those things, I think they just make Guitar Hero like a perfect storm of crummy business decisions and crummy game design decisions and like a whole bunch of things working together to brutally murder that franchise.
Okay, so if the Guitar Hero is a bad example, what's a good example? or a good bad example.
A good example of a bad sequel?
Well, not of a bad sequel, but of a franchise that went bad due to the industry penchant for sequelitis, or a good example of why sequelitis is not necessarily bad, if you would like to make such an argument.
I certainly don't think that sequelitis is that bad. Like, I'm one of those people that has played a lot of the heavily sequel franchises. Like, I've played, I think, all of the Call of Duty games except Ghost. I've played all of the Assassin's Creed games. Like, I've been on some of the franchise trains, and I quite like those games. Like, I think the thing is that I'm a real gameplay kind of person. Like, once I find a style of gameplay that appeals to me, I can play a lot of it before I get bored, particularly if it's a year between times that I play it. And games are different than other mediums in that you really do get a lot more refinement in the sequels, right? Like, Transformers 1, you know, the quality of it doesn't really impact Transformers 2 at all, right? Like, they're independent production processes that maybe the people making the movies have learned a few things, or maybe they screw a few more things up than they did last time. But fundamentally, they're different efforts. But when you're making a game, you learn a lot of things being the first game that you get to turn around and apply immediately to the second game, right? You start production on that second game with a fully realized game engine and gameplay mechanic that you know works, and then you can polish that, right? And that's something that you don't get in other mediums. And that's why I think that sequels in video games tend to be a lot better than particularly movie sequels. I mean, movie sequels, you don't even have to think at all to come up with examples of sequels to movies that are way worse than the originals. But in games, you kind of do. Like, a lot of franchises take until the second or third game to really hit their stride. Assassin's Creed is a great example of that. Like, Assassin's Creed 1 is a pretty good tech demo, but it's not really that great a game. They really didn't, in my opinion, start knocking them out of the park until Assassin's Creed 2. And I mean, a huge part of that was just, like, in Assassin's Creed 1, they were figuring out how this stuff worked. Like, they were doing something really different that hadn't been done before, but they hadn't got it completely dialed in. And once they got it dialed in, they could make a really fun game with it.
Yeah, for sure. It's also the Ubisoft way. Splinter Cell is probably a better example. So the first iteration gets done at Ubisoft Montreal, and then it gets reskinned in Shanghai. And even versions of Splinter Cell used to be done in Montreal. Odd versions were done over in Shanghai. And there was improvements in the tech, and you kind of get to reuse the technology, and that's kind of smart in the sense that it also gives your team a break. Making games is brutal. Like, the crunch, I haven't been in the industry for about 6 years now, but the reason I'm not in the industry is because making games is brutal. And letting the tech bake in one iteration and then doing a sequel the second time around, with the tech baked, is kind of a sound business strategy, I guess. But it also leads to this whole sequelitis issue.
Well, I think that there's good examples and bad examples of that. Like, I sort of was aware of this thing where you have two game studios using the same engine, and they're, like, firing one off from each other so that, like, you can get two, modern duty games each year, and they're based on the same engine or what have you, but by different teams. But there's examples of that where, so, like, obviously if you have two studios coming out with, a game each every 18 months, that's ridiculous. And, or at least to me, as someone who likes novelty and story in the games, and like, chances are they're not developing an entirely new, interesting story around the same characters in that amount of time. But there are interesting examples, like when Rockstar did Red Dead Redemption, for example. It wasn't a sequel, but they took all, like, exactly like Nigel says, that taking the game engine and the gameplay, like, they had the shooting mechanics, and obviously they, like, took the whatever driving engine they had and adapted to like, riding horses and things like that. But they made a really fun game and a lot more interesting game than they could have if they started from Hello World by basing it on some sort of GTA code base without having to just making it GTA 4.5.
Yeah, like when you could do something like that, I think you end up with a better game. And you look at some of the examples, particular games in the last year or two that have really kind of gone above and beyond. You know, both Last of Us and Bioshock Infinite, which are two of my favorite games of this year, like definitely they fall into that category of their games that are not sequels, but that gain a huge amount of a technological basis from the games that preceded them, right? Like Bioshock Infinite is basically Bioshock with like a completely new story and art and weapons and everything. And Last of Us is basically Uncharted with like new characters and art and story and everything. But you can see very clearly the foundations that those games were built on from their predecessors. And that's like the best case scenario. That's, you know, that's when you can create something that's got the best of both worlds, where you both have a solid base to build on. So you can cut down your production time, or you can use that time to create more quality, but you're not starting from scratch. And you're also not just saying, okay, well, we're just going to roll over the content. We're just going to make the same game again, which is what some of them do tend to do. Like Assassin's Creed particularly is very bad that way in the sense of the gameplay, right? That a lot of the gameplay is carried over almost exactly as is from game to game. And I like it because I like the gameplay, but I can certainly see how it could get on people's nerves. Like if you don't find the, you know, running across rooftops or through trees and jumping down on people kind of gameplay to be fun, it's not going to appeal to you. Whereas something like Last of Us will probably appeal to lots of people that didn't like Uncharted for whatever reason, because it's a very different game thematically and in terms of some of the gameplay elements.
Well, that approach of taking Uncharted and turning it into Last of Us is like the opposite. Like they're getting the good of reusing the game engine and not having to worry about it that as much, with the good of being able to rethink, like, what is the game and how does it feel and what is the story? And you contrast that to something like Diablo 3, which I'm not sure if either of you played Diablo 2 or 3, but basically after 10 years, they took what at the time was a really good game, Diablo 2, and they threw out all the code. And so they spent a lot of time making a new game engine from scratch that reproduced what they, and StarCraft was the same way, StarCraft 2, where they reproduced the gameplay and like all the what made that thing successful 10 years ago without actually revisiting all the things that games have learned in the last 10 years around like storytelling and things like that. And so 10 years later, a click fest where you just watch numbers get bigger is like, well, that's what we do on our iPad. So why am I getting a $60 AAA game to do that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's sort of the point I was trying to make is the best case is when you can reuse the tech and create a new IP, but failing that, even reusing the tech and reusing the IP is generally going to give you a better game than starting from scratch. And that's just kind of the reality of the cost of production for these big games and the sort of stuff that Parveen was talking about earlier of the crunch time and the tech base and all that is there's a huge amount of work that goes into the game before you have anything at all. And so starting with this huge leg up just gives you such an advantage in the production process that it's hard to catch up when you're starting from scratch. And you can see that in technology now that virtually all modern AAA games are using some sort of engine technology, right? Whether it's something that's licensed in the case of like Unreal Engine or something that's been internally developed and isn't licensed out, like, you know, the Frostbite stuff that EA is using for a lot of their games now that started with Battlefield, or the engine technology for like Uncharted and Last of Us and stuff like that. Like that's the game industry's effort to get as much of that benefit as they can. But that's no comparison for starting with like, okay, here's our like full set of animations for Ezio, and we're just going to turn that over into the full set of animations for Connor in Assassin's Creed 3, and like the gameplay's there, ready to go on day one, with you being able to just replace bits and pieces of the story and gameplay until you arrive at the final product that you want.
Yeah, well, the best thing that happened to games was like the Unreal Engine effect, where people started licensing the engine. and stopped wasting time, I guess, building the tech, and spent more of their time building the game themselves. But yeah, licensing tech is a double-edged sword. So you need the tech, but you also need like the institutional knowledge of being able to use the engine itself and really get the engine to go. So even if you license Unreal Engine or something like that, it's you're going to probably get really good at using the engine your second time around in your second game. So that's something to be aware about when you're looking at games.
Yeah, I don't think engines always even save time necessarily. Like you can say, okay, it'll take us a year to build this engine, or if we, you know, if we start with the engine, it'll take us a year worth of effort to mold it into the form that we actually need for this game. The thing about game development is that even having that time spread out and having a working game earlier just gives you so many advantages in terms of being able to try gameplay out early and see if it's fun. Like that's sort of the fundamental problem of game development, is that really the only thing that matters is how fun it is. And it's very difficult to tell how fun it is until you've actually got something that you can try. And so having that like 8 o'clock day one, we've got a character running around doing all this stuff, like every little bit of gameplay that you put in, then you can try out right away and say, hey, yeah, this is fun, or hey, this isn't fun. Whereas if you spend a year with like, you know, the nerds locked up in their cubicles writing the awesome shaders and the awesome rendering technology and all that, and the game designers, you know, sitting in their cubicles typing out a game design, and at the end of that year, you're like, all right, let's start making the game. Like you're way farther behind than if you can start making the game on the first day of production. Even if you end up having to do all that work that you were going to do to build the engine anyways throughout the process.
You say that an engine doesn't always even save time. And that surprised me the first time I heard that. I think I heard it first from you, because in my imagination, one of these game engines that you pay ridiculous licensing fees for, like Unreal Engine or Source, is like UIKit when you're developing on iOS, where they have all this documentation and they have all, it's all like, perfect, you know, the code is so good you don't even need to worry about what it looks like. It's just, you know, all well tested. And I've heard that that's not actually necessarily the case.
No, that's not remotely the case.
No.
to do what the fuck.
Yeah. So I think one of the other interesting things in terms of risk averseness is not even just sequeling, but just reusing IP in general, right? That video games have the same tendency that like films do to reuse stuff from other mediums and to use that to get a big boost. Because a part of also what's going on with sequels is not even just this sort of technical stuff of, you know, how do we make a good game? Well, starting from an existing game that's okay is easier than starting from scratch. There's also the factor of, if you've got something that people recognize and like, they're more likely to go out and buy it. And that's a big part of what drives the sequels as well, right? Like, if you look at something like Call of Duty, right? Like, the original Call of Duty games and, like, the Modern Warfare series of games and the Black Ops series of games and now Ghost, like, they're really all totally unrelated sets of games. Like, there's actually 4 or 5 different franchises that are all called Call of Duty, each of them consisting of between like 2 and 5 connected games. But they call them all Call of Duty because it's going to get people in the door, right? If they'd with Modern Warfare. Yeah,
you can
Warfare,
get like sequels of sequels. Like Modern Warfare is a, like Modern Warfare 3 is the third sequel of, to a sequel to Modern Warfare.
Right. Because once Modern Warfare had got traction by having the Call of Duty name attached to it initially, like now, you know, they looked and said, oh, people are just calling it Modern Warfare, so we can release Modern Warfare 2 and people are going to positively associate it with Modern Warfare 1. But the original one was Call of Duty Modern Warfare, right? Like that was the full title. And it really has nothing to do with any of the earlier Call of Duty games. Like there's no relationship there, right? It's just, they made another first-person shooter that's unconnected and decided to call it Call of Duty because Call of Duty games sold well. And so that's, you know, that's part of it too. Also, there's sort of the Batman factor, right? Like, Arkham Asylum probably would not have been as successful a game if it had just been some random brawler with some other characters that you never heard of, right? Even if it was just as good a game, it wouldn't have been successful because the Batman IP is just huge. It's one of the biggest IPs in the world in its ability to pull in people across all kinds of medium, right? And so you want that kind of stuff, right? And you see that a lot with games as well, that particularly with the comic book based ones, right? There's lots of games based on comic book franchises that that get pretty big. You see that in films a lot, right? Like films, there's a huge number of films that are coming either from existing IP, like the Marvel series of films with comic books, and films based on books and stuff like that, right? Like, entertainment has this sort of take the best stuff from other mediums and repurpose it because you know it's been successful there. And I think that's another thing that's going on with sequelitis. Sequelitis is another way of sort of doing that locally, right? That even if you're actually making a different game, you can gain something by associating it with a previous game, even that the association is only fairly loose.
Well, that ability for them to take, or just trend for them to take IP like Batman and make it awesome is pretty new. Because back in my day, like you would see like, oh man, a Superman game for the Nintendo 64? That's going to be great. You can fly around. Oh wait, it's actually literally the worst game of all time. Right? So whereas now, and I thought the same thing. I was like, oh yeah, there's a Batman game. I'm like, oh yeah, I'm sure it's based on the new movie that's going to come out, and it's going to just be like rushed to, but it wasn't like that at all. And that's changed the way that at least I perceive, you know, reusing IP in.
Yeah, definitely Arkham Asylum has been, I don't know if it's the start of the trend. I'd have to look carefully through a list of successful games over the last little while, but certainly Arkham Asylum is the most obvious modern example of like, here's taking an IP and using it in the way that movies have been using like books and comic books for a while as a sort of starting point for things, as a way to, to get some cultural resonance, as opposed to the Superman Nintendo 64 and a lot of the previous, like, oh, let's just get some crappy movie tie-in game out there. The crappy movie tie-in games seem to have moved to like, iOS and the other casual gaming platforms, yeah, and left the consoles for us real gamers.
Well, it's our Smurfberries thing, right? It was made as like, oh, hey, there's a Smurfs game coming out, or a Smurfs movie coming out, so let's make a game around it. And the next thing you know, it's literally the top grossing app in the world because they're selling 1 quadrillion Smurfberries.
So things like Arkham Asylum get made because the spreadsheet works. So if you walk into a Best Buy, the first thing you'll see is like the primetime display, and either EA or Activision or THQ, rest in peace, has bought that display, and then like start walking up and down the aisles. And on the ends, there's things called the end caps, and the publishers have bought those end caps as well. So you have to buy shelf space, and you have to buy the premier shelf space to actually push volume. And so if a publisher is going to greenlight a game, they have to say, oh, does it make sense for us to buy this primetime display? Does it make sense for us to buy this end cap? Can we do this for this particular game? And if we do this for this particular game, we can push this much volume. If we push this much volume, we're probably going to make this much revenue. Therefore, if we this much revenue, we can justify spending X amount in terms of budget on a game. And that's it. Like, sequels suck because retail sucks. Like, retail is broken. And we're seeing, hopefully, the deaths of the Best Buys and the rises of the Amazons. And the Amazons have infinite shelf life, or infinite shelf space. So I'd like to see in, like, a couple years from now, like, if the infinite shelf space actually helps bring out new IP as well.
This past Christmas, I tried to buy Journey at a Best Buy, and the guy looked at me like I was an idiot. Like, seriously? The best game of the entire generation? No, we don't stock that. That came out months ago.
Exactly.
I do think, though, that the move to digital distribution is probably, if anything, going to make that problem worse instead of better, because there's still going to be a long tail, right? There's still going to be certain games that are known and certain games that you have to put effort into finding out about. And it shifts the balance a little bit. Like it lowers the bar. It makes it possible for some games that couldn't have gotten mindshare because they didn't have conventional physical distribution before to get mindshare. But it also makes the problem worse in that now the mindshare and like people knowing about your game and being excited about your game from being given very little information about it becomes more important, right? In the current model, a publisher that was really dedicated to like, we want to improve art, which I'll grant you there aren't any like that, but sort of hypothetically speaking, you know, you could buy a game to success. If you thought you had some property that was good enough, you could say, hey, we've got this really good game. We're really going to push it because we think it's worth it. And we can, you know, we can buy that shelf space. And that's harder to do to some degree in these digital distribution kind of venues, right? You don't have that same prime physical real estate that can be purchased in the same way. So what I think is going to stand in for that kind of shelf space is the mindshare space. And a lot of the mindshare space is going to come from sequels and existing IP, because that's stuff that people will know, right? Like if you say to someone, hey, there's a new Batman game coming out, like they're immediately going to kind of know what that means. If you say there's a new Call of Duty game coming out, they're going to immediately know what that means. And you don't have to explain it any more to them to get them interested in, if it's the kind of thing that they're going to be interested in.
Yeah, possibly. There's two types of issues here. Studios are generally quiet and heads down, and then they try to go for a Hollywood launch. That's like in the Brave New World, you just can't do that. You have to be talking to your potential customers or something all the time, and like be on Twitter or be on Facebook or build your email list. Talk to them like all the time, like every single week. Say, hey guys, here's a screenshot of stuff we've been working on this week, and just like engage them currently. And that's the new type of distribution. So buying the end caps is not the new type of distribution anymore.
Yeah, well, look at Steam, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's not covered in, well, I don't know. I'm not currently looking at it, but my guess is it's not mostly covered in sequels to the same degree that the end caps in Best Buy are. Because you have these, you know, things like Papers, Please, which I just bought today from seeing it on Steam, and Hotline Miami, which was the only on the top 10 top-rated PS3 games on Metacritic of the year. The only one that wasn't a sequel was Hotline Miami, and it was number 10. And that's the kind of thing that just rakes it in Steam. Not saying they're billionaires or anything, but it did very well as a game that's out of nowhere and totally different than anything, and that no studio would be like, oh yeah, 8-bit graphics and guys in pig masks and you die a lot. Yeah, let's fund that.
Right, but those smaller games have a big advantage over the big AAA kind of games that they can get away with a bit of a softer launch because they don't have the huge budget they need to pay back, right? A AAA game is never going to get away from needing that opening day push and needing the big mind share in order to be successful. And I mean, maybe that's going to be the death of AAA gaming. I kind of hope not, because I do like those kinds of games, but that's certainly a plausible scenario. But I think the more likely thing is that, like I said, the AAA games will have to resort to other methods of getting the same kind of push that they got from shelf space, and that sequels and IP reuse are a good way to get that mind share, or at least good from their standpoint.
Just to put that into context, in 2008, the games that I was on, the budgets were between 6 and I want to say 22 million or so. So, and that's just the R&D, the development budgets, and there's marketing budgets on top of that. Today, like 6 years later, I think like a AAA game, a budget is going to be somewhere between $50 and $100 million. So there's ridiculous amount, like to make a AAA game is about as much money as it is to make a blockbuster Hollywood movie. And I don't think people really realize that. And that's part of the reason poor decisions are made in both Hollywood and in video games.
I don't know that they are poor decisions from the point of view of the people making those decisions. When you need that tent pole, when you need that big launch, like, you have to be very conservative and very risk averse, right? It's way better to have a $100 million movie that has like a 90% chance of grossing, you know, making back its money and maybe making a little bit more, than having a $100 million movie that has like a 50% chance of doubling its budget and a 50% chance of making nothing, right? Like, even though from a mathematical standpoint, those are sort of the same thing, like, when you're dealing with that amount of money, there's so much on the line in terms of the financial stability of the company and the personal reputations of the people involved and stuff like that, that you get risk averse. Like, no one wants to just slap down $100 million on like black on a roulette table.
Exactly.
So I don't think they're making bad decisions from the point of view of what they're doing, right? Like, hopefully what the drive to digital distribution will do is it'll at least give the little fish like a chance, you know, that they're at least on a more level playing field than they were before, that if they can get the mind share, if they can get people interested in them, they can be successful. The big fish are probably still going to be there and probably still going to be pulling whatever variation of the same tricks they've always been using keep working. And I think sequels and IP reuse will be a big part of that for the foreseeable future.
I don't think I would make the argument that there are these sequels and going back to the well and over and killing Guitar Hero is a bad financial decision for these companies. It just makes me sad, so I want to complain about it. Should we do a sponsor?
Sure.
I have a really cool sponsor that you guys may never have heard of, but these guys are really awesome. This episode is brought to you by Steam Clock Software. This is where you say ooh and ah.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Steam Clock designs and develops beautiful apps for iOS and, when necessary, Android. If you're looking for a top-notch team for your app project, visit www.steamclock.com.
Oh, man, Android. Don't get me started on Android.
You know, the crazy thing happened in the last 2 months, and I don't know what triggered it, but suddenly everyone and their dog wants an Android app. And Android has been coming for a very long time, and we've done Android on and off, but suddenly it's just like this Android bomb went off.
Oh, man. I have this like flashback to about, must be about 99 or 2000. I think did we all go to Simon Fraser University? Yeah, we did.
We did.
Yeah. Did they still have the Sun Microsystem Labs up there when you guys went?
They did have the Sun Labs when I was there, and the Next Labs.
Oh,
the next labs were awesome. The Sun Labs were substantially less awesome, shall we say.
every time I'm like building an Android app, I have this like an LSD flashback to like 1999 and being in that like stinky Sun Microsystems lab up there on the hill. Oh,
making a factory.
No, dependency injection into a abstract factory something.
What it's come to this. How are games on Android anyway? Do they have those yet?
I don't actually know. Do they have Ingress? Ingress is on my to-do list to actually play. Ingress is the in-world mine resources and build clans kind of thing.
Okay, game. So like the Clash of Clans for Android kind of thing?
Yeah, but in the real world. So like GPS-based.
Oh, yeah, there's a few people playing with this. This actually is a good segue to something I wanted to talk about, and that Parveen sort of brought up in the pre-show, which was that we talk about all this sequelitis and that most games that end up making a lot of money tend to be sequels, but that's not as true on, say, the App Store. So if I'm looking at the top grossing iPhone apps right now, and we see Candy Crush, Clash of Clans, Game of War, Heyday, Boom Beach, these are all number 7 is an existing IP, which is a Simpsons game, and number 8 also Hobbit. But it's not just such and such 2, such and such 3, such and such 4. And I don't know. So is that a temporary thing because it's still relatively young, or is that a consequence of the type of market?
Probably both. certainly like the in-app purchase stuff distorts a lot of those charts. My guess is if you looked at the top paid chart, you'd find more sequels there than you find on the top grossing chart, though probably still not to the same degree that you find them on like the top Metacritic or VG charts top for console games. So that, you know, that's got to be part of it. And I don't think there have been as many really successful franchises with really kind of unique IP as there have been on the consoles, right? That, yeah, there have been the few. The Angry Birds is like a great example of one that was big and was sequeled a lot.
I was gonna say, this is interesting, that in the top paid iPhone apps, which you mentioned, in the top 25 is 2K Sports, NHL 2K 2011, the 3-year-old NHL license game.
This is the iOS top charts you're looking at?
Yeah, the top paid iPhone apps, which I would generally, like, that's the game that if it was in, it's $3.99 here on the App Store, and it would probably be even less than $3.99 if you went into GameStop for a used copy, because that's the 3 years old NHL franchise game.
You probably can't even buy a copy of it.
It's probably at the bottom of the bin.
Yeah.
But Cut the Rope 2 is up there. It's the number 5 top paid iPhone app. Yeah. But it doesn't rank anywhere on top grossing, because who buys apps anymore?
So here's a thought experiment. Will we see AAA games come to iOS and Android? By AAA, I mean like big budget, big teams, takes a year to 18 to 24 to 36 months to build, and massive budgets.
Well, if looking in this top paid apps, there are some games that would hit that because they're ports, right? Like number 21 is Grand Theft Auto San Andreas. Number 24 is the 2K 2011, which are games roughly from the same era, roughly the same technical sophistication. Are you asking more about games that are developed from scratch for iOS, though?
Yeah, correct. So is there going to be a flip where the AAA game makers stop making console games and AAA game makers start making whatever we're calling this brave new world of mobile / tablet / whatever?
I kind of doubt it, at least not in the style of games that have been successful on consoles, just because so many of the good console games require a controller fundamentally. Like I wouldn't want to play. I tried playing a couple of the ports. Like I played all the way through the Max Payne iOS port, which I had previously played on the PC. And I was just like, all right, here's a game that I can imagine it being a little easier on iOS than some of them because of the bullet time mechanic, giving you a little more time to aim when you have crummy aiming control. And I played through it, and it was surprisingly playable, but it was not good. Like, I wouldn't recommend someone, you know, if someone said, hey, you know, Max, I really enjoyed Max Payne 3. I was thinking about going back and playing Max Payne 1. Should I get it on iOS, or should I try and track down a PC copy? I would say, you absolutely have to get a PC copy of it. Like, the game is not good enough on iOS to justify it. And that's, you know, that's a gap that you don't get between like PC and console games. Like, I have no problem recommending a console first person shooter to people, even though, yeah, they play a little better on the PC with the keyboard and the mouse. And maybe for some people they play enough better that's important, but most people are going to be able to play a first-person shooter just fine with a gamepad. Playing a first-person shooter on a touchscreen is brutal.
Word in the blogosphere, I can't believe I used that word. I'm going to edit that out. Word on the street is that Nintendo is starting to leak plans of what they're going to do for releasing Nintendo games on quote-unquote tablet and mobile platforms. Do you guys think that they're going to actually bring the big-hitting franchises Mario, Zelda to iOS?
Speaking of sequelitis,
I don't understand why people use those as the example, because those are the crummy example. If Nintendo wanted to like get a new license to print money, what they should do is they should port Pokemon to iOS.
Oh God, yes.
Like I don't even understand why you would bother. Like a Mario game on an iPad without a control would be terrible. You couldn't possibly make a good Mario game on iOS. You could make a fantastic Pokemon game on iOS. No problem. Pokemon would be better on iOS than it would be on like the DS.
That's actually true. It's funny that you say that. I was at Nigel's place a few days ago, and I played Pokemon when I was a kid, or like early teenager, I guess. And I'm dating myself.
Nigel and I are the old guys in the podcast, and Alan is 18. Just turned 19, actually.
No, I'm 19. I can drink now in Canada.
In Canada.
But I was watching Nigel's son play Pokemon, and he was like, "Oh, it's cool. There's this new one. It's really fun." I'm like, "Oh, what's new about it?" And he's like, "Well, it's nothing really new about it, but it's fun, right?" Like, he couldn't actually really describe any game mechanics that were different. And I looked at the screen. He was describing how it worked and the way his strategies were going, and everything that he said applied to the like 18 games ago that I played. In like 1998 or whatever.
Pokemon does not have a lot of variation in gameplay between different games. I mean, there's definitely new stuff every time, and the latest set, X and Y, which is what Jack was playing when you were over here, is certainly a lot better looking than most of them. Like, they've actually started using like really nice 3D models and animation, whereas even the last round of the DS games, though the DS can do 3D okay, like, they were still more or less just like sprite based kind of games. Whereas this is like, no, this is a proper 3D Pokemon and like 3D models and nice looking animation, stuff like that. So it's a really good looking game. But from a gameplay standpoint, from what I've seen, there's not a huge amount of innovation there. Pokemon also has a bit of a weird situation that they've really, I don't know if painted themselves into a corner is the right word, but the way they've sort of set the franchise up, it's actually very difficult for them to innovate because they carry all the Pokemon over every time and have sort of made that a thing. And so the expectation is that like all of the old moves and strategies and stuff are still going to be there. And it's just like a few new things. Like, this game's got the mega evolutions is what they're always going on about now. They've actually finished the main game, and now they're going around trying to collect all the various mega evolutions for their Pokemon, which is like this fourth evolution that you can use temporarily inside combat, you know, just to get a boost in that combat. And so that's obviously something that's not in the previous games that is like a real innovation, but the same basic, like, okay, you've got these moves, they've got kind of priorities, there's attack moves, there's defense moves, you've got these different types of Pokemon, like water and earth and grass and psychic and like that, like all that stuff is pretty much the same.
This tendency of hoarding from sequel to sequel is something that hurts, I think, when you get enough sequels. I've been playing Saints Row 4 on enough generations of the game has gone by that people have recommended it as a fun game, doesn't take itself too seriously. For some context, you're the president of the United States fighting aliens in the Matrix with superpowers. So that gives you a sense of, you know,
and you're a former gang seriously. Member, right? Like, you're a former gang member who has been elected president of the United States.
Yes. And you can kill people with a dubstep gun that wubs people to death. So this is how serious the game is. But it's collected from all the prequels, I can only assume. All these things that are remnants of you being a gang member. So there's little mini games in the game where it's like, and that you're sort of forced to go through as the part of the missions. It's like, all right, you're the president of the United States fighting aliens in a simulation, but you're going to commit some insurance fraud right now. Because why not? Right? That'd be fun. It's because they already coded it and it was already in the game. And it's kind of fun to just throw yourself into traffic and ragdoll along the street. So there.
Speaking of minigames, I think actually Mario Party would be a better choice for Nintendo to build on.
Yeah, Mario Party would be pretty good.
Yeah.
That'd be pretty good, too.
I've been playing a lot of, say, poker and chess and Go, and even, like, old-school board games like Nirishima Hex on the iPad. And, I'm surprised there hasn't been more, like, awesome, like, a board game kind of revival on the iPad.
I think there kind of is a bit of a board game revival going on the iPad. Like, I've certainly seen a lot of good board games ports. Like, that's one of my favorite, like, deep sort of gaming things on the iPad is board game ports. And there's some board game ports I actually like playing better on the iPad than I like playing the physical game. Because some of the ones that are really fiddly, like Ticket to Ride is a great example of that. Like, I like playing it physically, but it's so much like a physical game is like an event, you know, you got to get people together and you got to set stuff up. And whereas on the iPad, it's just like, yeah, you can just toss off a game. And Settlers of Catan, I can't stand playing the physical version of it, even though it's a pretty good game, just because there's so many little fiddly bits and it's so easy to get yourself like screwed in the first couple of turns of the game if you just make a couple of wrong calls. And then it's like, all right, I'm just kind of playing it out now. And you know, playing on the iPad, it's just like, if a game is going against me, I will just quit the game and say like, yep, I was gonna lose that one, I'm not gonna bother, and turn around and play against the computer. And I actually have fun playing it that way, whereas I rarely have much fun playing the physical board game version of Settlers of Catan.
I would say the physical or board game ports is the number one best use case for a bigger iPad, which is not enough to create an entire new type of iPad, but I would get, or also for like tabletop games for like D&D or something, you get like a 16-inch iPad would be awesome.
It's also a good example of the stuff that we've been talking about, of the like IP and SQLitis kind of stuff, is that's, I think, kind of iOS's version of that, right? That's the other medium that it can borrow from very effectively. That the mismatch, there's no mismatch between the genres and the gameplay styles and stuff like that. iPads and board games are like something where you can just move stuff across very cleanly and everything kind of holds together, and it gives you that name recognition, right? Anyone who knows board games knows, like, yep, Carcassonne and Settlers of Catan, and like those are all things that people know and that people are excited about. So you hear like, oh, hey, this game that I love the physical version of is coming out on the iPad. Like, that's going to give you that little bit of extra mind share, the mental end caps that you need to get people to pay attention.
Yeah, for sure. The other genre that I would love to see on the iPad, especially my background at Relic, is RTS games. I haven't found a great RTS game on the iPad. And I think like the iPad is actually really well suited. Tapping is really well suited to that genre. And I haven't seen anyone even attempt to make an awesome RTS on the iPad.
Yeah, the more lightweight RTSs that I've played, I've enjoyed and worked well. Like Great Little War Game is one that I played a fair bit of, and it's pretty good, but it's not like an amazing strategy game. Like it's fun for sort of a small size strategy game, but it's definitely no like StarCraft, right? It's
the closest I can think of is like Clash of Clans, basically.
Yeah, but with Clash of Clans, you're getting into all the in-app purchase dickery, right? That you have to put up with that, like all that stuff distorting your gameplay experience. Whereas what you want is you just want like someone to do like, here's an RTS, there's a campaign, you got to run through, you got to run through some missions that we've set up that we know are fun. And when you're done with that, you're done. And you don't have to buy, chests of Tiberium and bags of Tiberium and crates of Tiberium to keep your stuff running.
They would have that anyway, though.
Yeah, I suppose they probably would.
So I try to run this thought experiment all the time. Maybe we are on the wrong side of history. We, like us in the tech community, complain about in-app purchases and the Clash of Clans crap all the time. But like the Muggles, the normals, they never I've never heard of a normal person actually complain about an app purchase. They just plop down $200 on Zynga Poker and they're happy to do it, and they believe they've gotten their value for, you know, all that money that they've thrown down. So maybe us in the developer community is actually kind of on the wrong side of history, and like all games will be like this in the future.
We have an entire other episode actually about in-app purchase, but I because that's how much we hate it. But I think that the whole thing would be alleviated just a little bit if every time you made an in-app purchase, it told you how much money you've sunk into that game so far. So you like buy another like chest of Tiberium and it's like, sure, do you want to buy this like $9.99 chest of Tiberium? By the way, you've spent $4,200 in this game so far. And I think that would decrease the amount of.
Yeah, receipts should be better.
I do think the comparison to films is kind of interesting. The difference between between how successful, particularly critically successful, films are versus games.
Yeah, so I have this chart here of, I went into Metacritic and Rotten Tomatoes and looked at the top. You know, we think of the film industry as also being really heavily laden with these sequels. But if you look at the top 20 critically acclaimed films of the year, as well as like what's winning Oscars, but just on Rotten Tomatoes, all 20 of them are not sequels. Whereas if we look at the top 20 PlayStation games of the year on Metacritic, 17 of them are sequels of the 20, which is a pretty dramatic difference.
And even if you go to top grossing, which top grossing breaks not quite as well in film's favor, that with top grossing, it's like 10 sequels. And there's a couple others in there that I'd put in that category of like IP reuse. Like, yeah, okay, Oz the Great and Powerful and The Great Gatsby are not technically sequels to anything, but there's definitely some coattail riding going on there. Yeah, so it's like 10 sequels on top grossing, whereas there are 10 sequels of the top 20 grossing, whereas video games, it's, you know, it's the same split as on the Metacritic scores. That's like 15 or 18 sequels. Also interesting, I think the only film on both lists for the films is Gravity, and basically the lists are exactly the same for top critically acclaimed and top grossing for video games.
We got to do a show about that, about how, I mean, obviously video game criticism is broken in a lot of ways, but one of the ways that it's most broken, I think, is that you can basically buy a good rating. That like, oh, well, look at the production value in this. It's really rated really highly, whereas in film, that's not a problem. Like, you can get something like The Expendables, where they hire like 15 action stars and put $200 million into explosions, and it gets like 11% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you can certainly make big budget, terrible games if you put your mind to it.
It has
like Aliens Colonial Marines, I think, is the canonical example from last year. Duke Nukem Forever is the canonical example for the entire time that I've been in the games industry. So, you know, there's that, but I think more interesting is that for movies, there is this real split of like something can be critically successful and something can be commercially successful. And sometimes those things line up, but not particularly often. Whereas in games, they're always kind of the same thing, right? That like, I wouldn't disagree that like any of the ones on the top rated list, like don't deserve to be there, but there's definitely stuff that isn't there that does deserve to be there, you know, like, well, I don't know. It's sometimes with those indie games, it's hard even to know what years things are associated with it because they've got a longer tail. Like, I know that Last of Us and Bioshock Infinite came out last year, but like, when did Journey come out? That's got to be more than a year ago now. That's got to be like a year or two ago. Yeah. Has there been anything that's like that awesome in the indie game space since then? Like, I don't know. Do Papers, Please or Gone Home, like, are they? Yeah, they're probably better than some of this stuff, but like The Last of Us and Bioshock Infinite are pretty freaking good. Like, I have a hard time believing that that the successful indie games, you can just say categorically, like, yep, those are better than Last of Us or GTA 5 or Bioshock Infinite. Like, the games, because of that aspect of, you know, how much time you have to polish the gameplay and make it really sparkle, you know, you get these big budget games like being good because they've got the time and the breathing room to really polish them and to really make them work. And that's something you don't get in the same way in like film, right? You can't take a okay movie. You know, you can maybe take a bad movie and make it okay in the editing room, or take an okay movie and make it good in the editing room. But once you've completed principal photography, if the footage you've got is mediocre, you're not going to make an Oscar winner by polishing it in the editing room. Whereas you can kind of do that with games, right? Like you can say, hey, we made this game and it's not good enough, so we're just going to like start making it again, starting from what we've made so far. And that model has produced some fairly successful games, like the original Half-Life being the prime example of that, right? Where they basically made it once and said, nope, this isn't good enough, and started over again from the knowledge that they'd learned from the first time they did it and made something that was way, way better the second time.
Yeah, but film has like a pretty good substitute in HBO and like AMC and all these cable shows. So I watched the first episode of Breaking Bad and I thought it was terrible. And there's like Breaking Bad has just such a huge following, and every single person I talk to tells me I should watch Breaking Bad. And I've watched the first episode and I couldn't really get through it. And then they tell me, well, it gets better towards the end of the first season and the second season is awesome and stuff like that. Like, so there is room for like not films, but like these serials to actually age well. And if somebody asks me, you can only watch films or you can only watch HBO, I'd be like, yeah, I'm only going to watch HBO. So there is a pretty good substitute in that world. I'm not sure if there's a great substitute in the world of video games.
Well, I think what's going on in the world of video games is it's segmented in sort of filmed media too, right? Like, I mean, obviously these lists we're looking at here are of films and there's no TV shows on them, right? Is Breaking Bad, you know, better than Gravity? Like, what does that question even mean? You can't, you know, both of them were filmed entertainment that completed itself during this year, but you can't really compare them. Like, it's not a meaningful question. Maybe saying is Gone Home a better game than BioShock Infinite just is an equally meaningless question, that the indie game world and the AAA game world are just sufficiently different. There's that cross comparing them is kind of like trying to cross compare movies and TV shows, that the comparisons just start falling down and you just have to say, like, all right, I'm going to treat those two things differently. Like, there should be a like Metacritic indie games list and a Metacritic mainstream games list, and those are just different lists that you look at both of them and try and decide which games you're going to go for.
Yep. But if you ask, like, so the only film that I've watched on this list is Gravity. And if you ask me, should I watch, if I could only watch Gravity or if I could only watch Game of Thrones, I'd be like, yeah, Game of Thrones, totally. And I don't even like fantasy and I love Game of Thrones. So,
I don't know. I mean, I have watched neither Gravity nor Game of Thrones because being a parent, I only ever watch kids movies anymore. But, I don't think I would make that call, you know, given the choice between being able to see like a bunch of different 2-hour things versus a single, you know, a single episodic TV show over and over again. Like, I don't know. That'd be a pretty tough call. Like, I don't think I could say, oh, I'd way rather see a few TV shows that sort of maintain their quality over the long run versus lots of little things. I mean, yeah, that, I guess it's kind of the same thing, you know, the same thing as the original question of like, should you be going for sequels if you like the gameplay, or should you be seeking out new gaming experiences? And even though I'm a little bit in the sequel camp on games, I think I kind of put myself in the original experience camp on movies, just because I do like repetition in gameplay. Like, I enjoy the sort of getting good at the gameplay aspect of things in a way that I don't quite enjoy watching that long a story in TV. Like, I have a really hard time keeping up even with episodic TV shows that I like, just because it's like, I've kind of gotten burned out on it a little bit.
Yeah, and it's probably really difficult to sustain a show over, say, 7 seasons. 7 seasons times, I don't know, 16, 18 shows.
What is The Simpsons at? I think they're like 30, 40 years now?
Something like that.
Yeah. I've stopped watching The Simpsons.
No.
I think everyone has stopped watching this. Does anyone actually watch The Simpsons anymore?
Maybe it's just some artifact of the algorithm they use to measure who's watching that makes them think it's still being watched.
Like maybe Nielsen sent out like a bunch of their logbooks with like The Simpsons just pre-printed in it because they assumed everyone was watching it, and like people just aren't watching it anymore, but the pre-printed logbooks keep coming back with like, hey, people are still watching The Simpsons.
Or maybe there was like an overflow, like this, the computer system doesn't handle more than 20 years or something like that, and then it just loops back to the data from the 90s, and they're like, this show is super hot. So what are you working on nowadays, Parveen?
Oh, me.
I know what Nigel's working on.
Android, right? He was complaining about Android. So it's got to be Android stuff he's working on.
So working on an Android app that is making me pull my hair out because A, it's Android, and B, embedding a SIP client in an Android app, which is even way more fun. It's tons and tons of fun.
That sounds like lots of fun.
Yes. I should stop doing these things.
If we do our podcast client, you know, we're going to have to get involved in the exciting world of VoIP clients. So,
well, it's funny. So we've been talking about and playing with building a podcast recording client at SteamClock, and recording. And part of why we started this show was in order to get an understanding of what it's like to record it and what the challenges are. And definitely the Skype, like even on this call in particular, the Skype has been bad, but listening to Skype do things like when Nigel cuts out, it will then, when he reconnects, catch up in like 1.5 times speed what he's saying. Like, I don't want to write that. Is that part of SIP? Or we have to do that ourselves?
That's the jitter buffer between RTP, which is a transfer protocol that sends the data, and the codec. Silk is the codec that Skype uses, and RTP is the protocol to send packets over the wire. And in between those two things, there's a thing called a jitter buffer, and the jitter buffer tries to reduce jitter. And it's one of those three things that's messing up. I think it was in the jitter buffer that I was hearing Nigel break up. I know too much about VoIP.
But that kind of sounds like a no, we wouldn't have to write that ourselves. That's one of those off the shelf.
You would have to license it. You would actually have to license it.
Of course we would.
There's two ways to go about it. There's the SIP way to go about it. There is an open source version library called PJSIP, but it's GPL.
It's kind of shitty, but yeah. Oh, great. GPL.
Wait, an open source library is a little shitty. I'm shocked.
And has inappropriate licensing.
Somebody fetch me my fainting couch and my smelling salts.
So, A, it's shitty. The port to iOS is not good. But all of the SIP stuff is actually good. And Twilio actually uses it for their Twilio voice client. But I think they've licensed it. I think you could actually purchase a non-GPL license, and then you would have to modify it to actually work in iOS. By the way, you actually don't want to do this. You actually do not want to do this. That's probably your SIP choice. In terms of the other choices, XMPP and Jingle, which is what Google Hangouts probably uses. So XMPP does the handshaking of, hey, let's talk together on the thing. And then Jingle would be the protocol to like send voice across and stuff like that. There's a live Jingle that Google has open sourced. The iOS version also not great. Yes.
Okay, sounds good. Parveen's writing our VoIP.
I'm not. I'm gonna stop. I'm gonna stop doing like stuff. Oh, it's so terrible. So terrible.